Good evening, everyone. Welcome to tonight's conference call. My name is Dan Green. I will be substituting for Dr. Shamroth tonight. So tonight is Sunday, August 27, 2023. So glad you all could dial in. I think we had three folks that submitted cases or issues that they were concerned about. So I'm going to see if Stephanie is on the call. Let's see. Give me one second here. Stephanie, are you on?
No.
Okay. How about Ashley? Ashley, are you on the phone? Stephanie, can you, I see there's someone named Stephanie, a 626 number. Did you send a question in to Karina? Stephanie?
I did not send a question in.
Must be another Stephanie, sorry. But thanks for letting me know. All right, so it's either Stephanie or Ashley or Vanessa.
I'm Vanessa. I'm here.
Great. All right, Vanessa, why don't we take your question first? If you could just tell the other listeners on the call what you wanted to discuss.
So I have a case on my case list for OB. It's a case of fetal demise, so it's like one of the most anxiety-provoking ones that I have. So I'm just not really sure how to tackle it. The background is the way that my old practice used to work is the midwives used to manage normal labor. And unfortunately, I was called late in the morning for a Category 2 tracing, persistent Category 2 tracing. So I had to do an urgent C-section with the hospitalist while I was on my way in. The baby was undergoing CPR by the time I got into the OR, and, you know, unfortunately, you know, after a few hours, had a fetal demise.
I'm sorry. Excuse me one second. I'm sorry. Can you repeat, just back up? I heard the Category 2 tracing and the midwife part. I'm sorry. Can you pick it up there again, please?
Oh, all I was saying is that, you know, by the time I was involved, I had to do I was concerned about, you know, acidemia at that point based on the tracing that I was seeing, and to do a stat C-section with the hospitalist as I was on my way into the hospital. By the time I came into the hospital, the baby was delivered and they were doing CPR, and I finished the C-section. So I included it into my case list because I assume that that's something that I have to include into my case list. I mean, it's already submitted now. And the baby ultimately ended up dying. And so I kind of wanted to know how to address that. I know there'll probably be a lot of questions regarding that particular case and the outcome.
So before we get into the questions, I mean, the midwife was one of your practice's midwives, is that correct?
Correct.
And were you aware that the patient was even there?
I was aware that she came in for admission, like, early in that morning for, like, prom. She was supposed to be induced for late term, but she prommed prior to induction. So she presented for prom, and she was inducing her because of that. But I was not aware that she had a Category 2 tracing until, well, like, hours later.
Mm-hmm. So how many weeks was she?
She was exactly 41 weeks, 41-0.
Okay, and what was her age and parity?
G1 to T0.
Okay. So, and the APGARs for the baby?
Were 0 and 2.
And the baby ultimately died?
Succumbed, correct.
Okay. Well, in terms of, you know, the question isn't going to be, tell me about, you know, patient number 26 or what have you. they're going to say, I see that, you know, patient number 26 came in as a late-term patient. Does it say the midwife at all on your case list? Can you tell me what it says on your list?
So I did not include the midwife was the one who was managing the labor, nor did I include that the hospitalist was the one that delivered it, because I just felt like at that point it was getting too confusing to follow. So I basically wrote it as if I was the one primarily managing the patient, with the hope that I could explain the situation if it were to arise.
Yeah. Well, first of all, so they may say to you, it says Category 2 tracing, I assume?
Correct.
And it says that C-section?
Correct.
Okay, so probably some of the things, at least initially, that they're going to ask you is, you know, they may ask you what makes a tracing a Category 2 tracing. So in other words, how do you determine somebody is a Category 2 tracing, and what would you tell them?
So the definition of Category 2 tracing, there's multiple components that can classify something to Category 2, fetal tachycardia. However, if it has moderate variability, at that point, still Category 2. You can have moderate to minimal variability with late decelerations or variable decelerations or even prolonged decelerations, as long as there is some variability. However, if it happens to have minimal variability with recurrent lates, recurrent variables, or sinusoidal patterns, those kind of are more Category 3. But Category 2 shows more signs of fetal reassurance because of the variability.
So when you have a patient, when you have a patient with a Category, when you have a patient with a Category 2 tracing, how do you, how long would you observe Category 2 if it persisted before you would intervene? I don't mean with intrauterine resuscitation. I mean intervene to perhaps a C-section or operative delivery if possible.
So if I have a patient with a persistent Category 2, and it depends on, you know, how she's progressing or her parity. If it's a prime who's still in latent labor, who has persistent Category 2 tracing, despite resuscitation, I usually watch for 30, 45 minutes before I decide to make a decision if it's not responding to my resuscitation. Because at that point, I'm afraid for fetal tolerance of labor, and we're so remote from delivery. At that point, at least, like, the minimum probably is an hour where I would wait, as long as I have variability before I recommend.
Minimum or maximum?
I would say that's a minimum, as long as I have good variability.
Okay. So how long was it for this patient between the diagnosis of her Category 2 and delivery?
Well, with chart review, it was probably like 4 or 5 hours before I was notified where she has Category 2 tracing.
Okay, so this is how is one of the ways the question can go. Since your list doesn't say that, you know, you were notified or anything else, they're going to think that you were managing this patient. So they're going to say, basically, how long did you watch this tracing? And that's going to be your opportunity to say, and you'll want to be proactive about it as much as you can. You want to kind of introduce this as quickly as you can, not to throw somebody else under the bus, obviously. And
right.
But you're going to want to explain, well, you know, despite the fact that I didn't list it here, this patient was being cared for by one of the midwives in our practice. She alerted me, you know, 4 hours after she arrived, or I'm making this up, obviously, you know, of the Category 2 tracing that had been present, or the informed me of the Category 2 tracing, which had been present for X hours. I immediately made my way to the hospital. However, the hospitalist was also made aware of the tracing and had begun the C-section. The baby was out by the time I arrived.
Okay.
Again, it's important to get all that stuff out since you didn't list any of it.
Okay.
Technically they would not have wanted you to put baby information there, so like Apgars and weight, because you didn't do the delivery. But that's a minor point. So, you know, questions that could come up is, you know, that could come up include things like, what is your practice's policy in terms of when a patient is admitted and begun on Pitocin? Are you just made aware? Are you expected to come in? You know, what are the policies that you have, and what have you done to change these policies in light of the experience in this case?
I guess in the exam mode, I would say the practice policy is that the midwives, you know, are, as long as it's a low-risk patient, they're comfortable managing, they are granted autonomy, you know, and they have discretion when they feel they need to consult a medical doctor. And at the point that she consulted me, I felt like, you know, it was a little bit too late, and it was a newer midwife, but there is no hard and fast rule. So the patient can move on to Pitocin, having a Category 2 tracing, and we wouldn't be made aware unless the nurses or charge nurses or the midwife contacted me regarding that. And so, you know, I guess this is not an exam mode. I'm no longer in that practice, not because of this case, but because of other things, but I was already on my way out before this case occurred. You know, just debriefing with everyone, I told her, you know, it's a newer midwife, and I kind of explained to her kind of the signs of concerns as far as the fetal tracing, kind of debriefing with the bedside nurse, the charge nurse, and also the midwife as far as, like, why they had reassurance and why they felt that I didn't need to be contacted. And I guess, you know, ultimately they thought the patient was making progress. You know, she was complete by the time they contacted me. However, complete or not, this has been persistent for 4 hours, and, you know, we're still remote from delivery. You kind of have to take into consideration fetal reserve. So we did discuss as far as, like, management, active management of Category 2 tracing and ways to be more proactive, the implementation of that. I'm no longer at that practice, so I'm not aware as far as if they are taking that into consideration.
Were the nurses concerned at all during this patient's labor?
No.
Okay. I mean, the other thing that, you know, the other point that you want to be able to make is, you know, since this occurred, you know, the nurses and or charge nurse, if there's concern about the tracing that's not being acted on by the midwife, you know, has the autonomy to reach out and contact the MD as they see fit.
Okay.
Just like if you were doing something that was inappropriate, they could theoretically call the chairman or chairperson, I should say.
Right. Okay.
So that's, you know, that's presenting the story again. Kind of would like, you know, obviously wait for them to bring up the case. And, you know, I would start off, this was a really tragic case, you know, being managed by one of the midwives in our practice. I was providing backup and was contacted when the patient was fully dilated after 4 hours of a Category 2 tracing. I immediately left for the hospital. In the interim, the hospitalist delivered the baby with 0 and 2 Apgars. I completed the C-section, which is why it's listed here, and unfortunately the baby passed away. And then they'll ask you, you know, what could you have done to...
I'm not the hospitalist more involved. Oh, my God.
I'm sorry? Hello? Are you still there?
Well, this is Vanessa. I'm still here, but I wasn't the one who made the comment.
Oh, sorry. So other questions that they could ask you. Now, this wasn't exactly a stillbirth, but other things, you know, but it was a fetal death at term. So other things they could ask you would be, you know, what are risk factors, for example, for patients with stillbirth? Again, I know this is not a stillbirth exactly, but even a an intrapartum stillbirth, again, baby had a 5-minute Apgar of 2, so doesn't quite fit, but the questions could still be asked. So what are risk factors?
Well, I would, complete placental abruption. I would say at this point, like an inappropriately managed category, 2 or 3 tracing could cause a fetal demise prior to delivery. Deterioration of maternal status. So if the mother, for instance, has an AFE or a cardiac event that requires, you know, resuscitation and delivery is a little bit delayed due to that, that can also result in a fetal demise. We're talking about intrapartum, right? I'm just trying to...
Correct.
Okay.
Intrapartum or somebody who comes in with a IUFD.
IUFD, I would think, like poorly controlled diabetes, someone with severe preeclampsia, who, like I said, had abruption or some placental event, someone with a cord accident, COVID.
Okay. What would your workup consist of if you had a patient that came in with an IUFD?
For starters, I would want to do a fetal, so examine the fetus to see if there's any overt causes that I can see, fetus and placenta. For instance, if I see a complete abruption, that would, a huge clot all along the placenta, that would be something that would be concerning for the cause of the demise, or if there's a true knot. I would offer the family a fetal autopsy and genetics to see if there were any also underlying cause that were undiagnosed antenatally for the patient. I would also do, extensive history and physical for mom. So if mom, for instance, had a, you know, flu-like symptoms with a high fever and there was concern for COVID or flu, do some respiratory swabs from that standpoint for maternal to see if that was contributing to what occurred with the fetus.
No, that's good. All right, so again, these are some of the didactic questions that could be asked. Obviously, getting the details of the history, if you will, of the patient. But remember, they're not going to be looking for a 5-minute dissertation and explanation about what happened with the baby. So you really have to be succinct and to the point.
Okay.
And again, it's going to look like you watched the Category 2 tracing longer than. Because obviously it doesn't say, you know, midwife called for backup, whatever. So you want to introduce that, but you got to be, you know, to the point because they'll cut you off. Okay. All right. So questions again they could ask you would be intrapartum causes of fetal death or antepartum causes. So I thought you did a nice job. Risk factors would include nulliparity, AMA, obesity, cigarettes, alcohol. African-American patients are at increased risk. So you mentioned placental abruptions or placental insufficiency, obviously chromosome or genetic. Infection. If you're not speaking, could you guys put yourselves on mute, please? Thank you. Genetic abnormalities, infection, cord events, all could cause a stillbirth or an intrapartum stillbirth, but more so, many of those would be antepartum. Obviously, the chromosome or genetic would be typically antepartum. And I thought you did a nice job, Vanessa, in terms of your workup. The two main things would be the placental pathology, as you mentioned, and fetal autopsy. That will, in about 65% of cases, that will tell the reason for the stillbirth. It excludes about another 40% of causes. If you add genetic testing, and in this case you'd want to do generally a chromosomal microarray because it's going to pick up more subtle deletions or than, for example, a karyotype. If you do that and you add the antiphospholipid, especially if the patient or the baby had evidence of fetal growth restriction, or mom had evidence of hypertension or preeclampsia, that'll give you about another 10% of the causes. And then finally, you want to look if there was preterm labor, evidence of chorioamnionitis. Of course, you're going to want to work her up from an infectious standpoint.
Okay.
And this is all important, of course, for counseling and, you know, trying to prevent recurrence in the future. So nice job with the didactic questions. Do you feel comfortable talking about this case? Any more comfortable?
Yeah, I guess I feel more comfortable. I wish I would have proactively realized I could have put a little bit more information to make it seem less so like I did it. But, again, I didn't want to throw anyone under the bus. And I just
right, but if the case comes up, you need to be proactive. And by that, I mean, you don't want them to say, how come you followed this, you know, for so long? You want to volunteer, hey, I was, you know, called late for this patient, you know, and give the those details, because you don't want it to seem like you're making anything up. It's kind of like the endometrial biopsy before an endometrial ablation. Sometimes people
right.
don't list it on their list, you know, but you volunteering it as opposed to them getting around to saying, well, how come you didn't do a biopsy here? Oh, I did one. I always do one. Well, maybe you do and maybe you don't, but if you volunteer it, you know, ahead of time, I don't mean before they ask about the case, but I mean, when the case comes up, you know, there's more certainty that you actually did it as opposed to just trying to cover your tracks.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
Very good. Okay. Thanks, Vanessa, and thanks for sending the question in. Okay, so let's see. Stephanie or Ashley, have you joined us yet? If you are, please unmute yourself. Stephanie or Ashley that sent the question in to Karina for tonight's. Maybe we should make the other Stephanie do it. I'm just kidding. Interesting. Okay. So Stephanie's question. What do you do, and this is kind of piggybacks on Vanessa's case, but what do you do, she wrote, if you have something that you accidentally left off of your list, of course, which is already submitted. Her example included an OB, a 40-year-old G8P5, who was being induced at term. She had 4 prior vaginal deliveries. She got an epidural and had hypotension with desaturation, category 2 tracing that was unresponsive to maternal resuscitation, and blood pressure management. She did require primary C-section, and the concern was maternal hypotension after epidural was placed, even though the patient was listed under anesthesia complications on her list. Is that okay? Well, first of all, the list is in now, so there's not a lot we can do about it. But this is actually fairly easily corrected. In case like this, you just want to say, you know, it's under anesthesia complications. So they might say, well, what was the anesthesia complication? In which case, you would just volunteer the hypotension, you know, and she was given ephedrine, you know, with position changes, increased IV fluids, and everything you did to try to resuscitate the baby and overcome the maternal hypotension. So it'd be easy to introduce and volunteer that. It's not a big deal if they say, why did this patient end up with a C-section? Again, she had persistent category 2 and failed intrauterine resuscitation, nor could we correct the patient's blood pressure. Now the question then becomes, well, was the blood pressure corrected? Because if the blood pressure was uncorrected, then you're doing a C-section on somebody with low blood pressure, and you know, potential complications as far as that goes. And the other question that would occur to me is, why wouldn't they be able to correct their blood pressure with some ephedrine or what have you? So those would be the kinds of questions that could come up, you know, how you would manage it. I would have a rough idea of the, even though anesthesia gives the ephedrine, I would have a rough idea of the dose of the ephedrine that would typically be given for a patient with hypotension after an epidural. The other example she sent in was a 31-year-old G3P3 with menorrhagia and chronic pelvic pain who had a hysterectomy after failed medical management. She had inability to complete an endometrial ablation due to a suspected perforation during the procedure. The endometrial ablation was left out in her case list. She didn't have that portion, so she didn't list the endometrial ablation. So, again, that would be something that, well, there's two ways to manage this. Certainly not suggesting anyone be dishonest in any way. But one thing that could, you know, she had heavy vaginal bleeding or abnormal uterine bleeding. She had chronic pelvic pain, and she failed medical management. So, you know, it would be natural, and someone would not even think necessarily that the patient had the ablation or an attempt at an ablation, that is. So there's two ways to manage it. Certainly you can introduce the ablation. Well, you know, we tried with conservative surgical management before we proceeded to the hysterectomy. Unfortunately, there was a suspected perforation, but the ablation was unsuccessful and couldn't be completed. Perfectly reasonable. Then they'll talk to you about risk factors for ablation. They'll talk to you, I'm sorry, for perforation, incidence of perforation, things that would compromise an ablation, so anatomic factors that reduce the effectiveness of an ablation, what have you. They may talk to you about how come a subsequent ablation was not attempted. So this would be, these would be some of the questions that would come up. Again, the other part is it makes very good sense that the patient had these problems, failed medical management, had chronic pelvic pain on top of it, which the ablation may not have addressed in any way. I mean, it might have improved it, and it might not have. So it would not be unreasonable that the patient ended up going with a hysterectomy. You know, the reason I would err, however, on the side of mentioning the ablation, even though it's not listed on the list, and I would just say I don't, you know, I'm sorry, it got cut off my list or in my revision of my list, it somehow was excluded. But the reason I would include it is because the patient's 31. So unless she had some sort of pretty significant pathology like a really large uterus, adenomyosis, something like that, it does give you a little bit more cover attempting to do a less invasive surgery on a relatively young patient. In a minute, I'm going to pause and see if anybody has any questions about either of these two cases or about Vanessa's case before we get. So if anybody has any questions, I've unmuted you guys. Feel free to chime in. Questions or comments, folks?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. Hi, my name is Penny. I don't have a question about those particular cases, but if the third volunteer is not available, I was just wondering if I could ask a question about my own case after we're done.
Yeah, well, go ahead. Why don't you do that before the
okay.
I don't think Ashley has – I haven't seen anybody join recently.
Has joined? Okay, good. I appreciate that. So these are general questions about patients from my office list who are under pediatric and adolescent gynecology. So my first patient, she's a 14-year-old G0 who presented with severe dysmenorrhea and heavy menstrual bleeding. Her pain was refractory to over-the-counter NSAIDs. She also failed treatment with high-dose norethindrone. And she had, we deferred an examination for this young girl, and she eventually followed up with a primary gynecologist who was not me. She came in kind of for a consult for a laparoscopic excision of endometriosis. I guess my question primarily is, under this category of pediatric and adolescent gynecology, should I expect questions that are specific to that kind of subcategory of patients outside of the realm of severe dysmenorrhea? I mean, she just happens to be a teenager with a pain symptoms that could be applicable to any age group. So I'm not sure what else they may ask besides, you know, primary dysmenorrhea, you know, dysmenorrhea related to a pediatric patient or adolescent patient.
Yeah, so yes and no, which is definitely the answer I know you wanted to hear.
it's the honest one. It's okay.
General, look, they could always have a case of the day on pediatric gynecology. It would be a little bit unusual, not completely impossible. I mean, you know, they could ask you, for example, primary amenorrhea could fit under, technically fit under the category of pediatric or adolescent GYN.
Sure.
But, you know, so that could come up as a case of the day. In fact, when I took my boards, that was one of my cases of the day. They could take your patient and say, you know, and say, well, she's 14, da-da-da. Let's say instead of her coming in with pain, she came in, you know, because she hadn't had a period yet. You know, how would you, what's your differential and how would you work her up? So they could change that. They could do that with any case. Usually it happens more in folks that are subspecialists. I don't mean pediatric gynecologists. I mean like, you know, they're urogynecology and, you know, while she might be under pediatric GYN, you know, she had a UTI at 17 or something, you know, you stretch to kind of fit it in. Or, you know, if it's, you know, cancer oncologists, you know, they always have, you know, patient came in with stage three, whatever. And, oh, by the way, you know, she's under urinary tract infections because she had a UTI.
Yeah.
But she was coming in for her, you know, follow-up for stage three cancer. So those folks definitely are subject to them not bastardizing the case, but certainly changing it significantly. If you have a broad enough list, usually they're going to stick more to the case. But if you had, let's say, 10 people, and I'm making this up, of course, if you had 10 people on your list that had dysmenorrhea, you know, and say we saw it. Then you do run that risk because they're not going to ask you about dysmenorrhea 10 times.
Sure. Okay, that's
so they could ask you one time about the 25-year-old, for example, you know, who may ended up having had endometriosis, whatever. And if they want to ask you about pediatric GYN, they could change this completely. They could say, let's say she was only 10 and she came in with vaginal discharge. And I'm talking about foreign bodies, talking about, you know, concern for abuse, all sorts of things like that.
Okay.
Sure, so I know I've just ruined your night, and I apologize.
No, that's good to be, particularly because a lot of my patients are, you know, heavy AUB and dysmenorrhea. I want to know what to think about with these teenage patients and if they'll kind of digress a little bit from the main you know, their main issue. So that is very helpful. I appreciate you letting me ask a question.
Go ahead.
Hello? Oh, sorry. This is I'm a candidate, but I actually do some peds guy, and there's a committee opinion on adolescent dysmenorrhea that you can just probably just like highlight the bullet points in there, and like early endometriosis.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing that.
Thank you very much.
But from a topic standpoint, I would you know think about the more common things. They're not going to ask you ambiguous genitalia. They're not going to ask you about some of these advanced, they're not going to ask you about Meyer-Rokitansky-Kuster-Hauser syndrome unless it's in the, you know, unless it's related to primary amenorrhea.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you, Ashley.
Thanks. One last call for Ashley. Otherwise, I'm going to try to do her case. Ashley? Ashley stood us up. Okay. So she writes in, her question involves how to put together discussing a case, and I'll read you the case in just a second. Well, let me read it to you now, actually. She's a 45-year-old G5P2 with recurrent stage 2 pelvic organ prolapse, repeat a history of a laparoscopic sacral hysteropexy and a history of bilateral ureteral implants. Interesting. Cystoscopy showed the stent placement. She had an XLAP with lysis of adhesions, mesh removal. She had a supracervical hysterectomy, bilateral salpingectomy, sacral colpopexy, perineurophy, cystoscopy, and the stent removal. The uterus weighed 424 grams with leiomyoma, adenomyosis. The endometrium, ECC, and fallopian tubes were all benign. She did have a 9-day length of stay with a small bowel obstruction, which was treated with a resection. And the added information that Ashley provided, so briefly the patient had her surgery, which was done in conjunction with colorectal surgery, who also followed the patient post-op. Excuse me. The patient had persistent nausea and vomiting. The patient underwent a KUB and small bowel follow-through, which were negative for small bowel obstruction. She had a brief NG tube placed, which was discontinued by the patient herself. GI became involved, and their consult suggested that the patient had a gastroparesis. The patient was passing flatus and intermittent bowel movements during this time. By post-op day 9, she was tolerating PO and was just discharged to home. She then re-presented to, I'm believing, another hospital and was diagnosed with a small bowel obstruction and had a resection. So how to put all this together? Good question. I would, you know, it's a lot of it is in writing here. At least what happened leading up to, or at least through the surgical part. So I don't think the surgery itself needs to be reiterated other than to perhaps add that she had an XLAP with lysis of adhesions, including lysis of adhesions by colorectal surgery. So that would be one thing I would want to include so the examiner has an idea of how significant or extensive we think the adhesions were, you know, if we had to get help in, if you will. Not to mention they were following the patient post-op. So the question then becomes, you know, how do you distinguish an ileus from a small bowel obstruction? And, what, you know, if the patient's passing gas, tolerating PO, and even having some intermittent bowel movements, how does she have an obstruction? So that's a great question. I think how I would explain this are the possibilities where the patient had an ileus initially, perhaps after the surgery, which resolved, and then developed an obstruction. I mean, obstructions, as we know, don't form necessarily in a day or two. They can occur, you know, days to weeks or even longer after surgery. She may have had a partial small bowel obstruction. So if anybody want to volunteer to answer some questions about small bowel obstruction? Stephen, do you want to be volunteered?
I can volunteer.
Go ahead. First name.
It's Vanessa. I was volunteering.
Oh, that's nice of you, Vanessa. Thank you. So any idea how a partial small bowel obstruction would present?
Partial small bowel obstruction can present with, you know, nausea and vomiting, with abdominal distension, and actually can have some diarrhea as well.
Okay. So what would you expect to find on physical exam if you had a patient, let's say, with an ileus?
Distension, hypoactive bowel sounds.
Okay, versus a small bowel obstruction, what might you find there?
I would still expect some distension, but I would have, with bowel sounds, intermittent, you would hear some intermittent, like, increased bowel sounds, but yeah, increased peristalsis, like, as far as the bowel's actively trying to move, but nothing's passing. I forgot the term that we're supposed to describe when it comes to that.
Okay. And what about on x-ray? What would you see on x-ray?
Air fluid levels.
In which one?
I would expect air fluid levels when it comes to small bowel obstruction.
Okay. What about if the patient had an ileus? What might you see in that case?
I think as far as an ileus, you just need distended bowels, loops of bowels. You don't necessarily see air fluid levels.
Okay. Is there any other test that you might get if you had a patient that had, say, nausea and vomiting, let's say 4 or 5 days post-op?
I would get a CT with IV and oral contrast.
So would you give them oral contrast if you thought she had a complete obstruction?
No, I would not.
Okay. Do you know how common ischemia is in patients with small bowel obstruction?
I mean, I think just anecdotally from my experience, I haven't had a lot of patients with ischemia, so I would say not as common. It's usually something causing an obstruction, but not necessarily ischemia. This is anecdotally. So if I had to say that, probably like.
But I guess what I'm asking is this. I'm sorry, Vanessa. Didn't mean to talk over you, but I'm thinking about ischemia in the presence of a patient with an obstruction. So the patient has an obstruction. How often do we find ischemia?
Oh, okay. Like a secondary cause.
Well, it's not really a cause. It's a result. It's a result.
A result.
Obstruction,
right. I mean, I would say 20 to 30%.
Okay. All right. Good. Let's talk about this one. So, if Ashley were on, I think what I would suggest to her is again mentioning the presence of colorectal surgery, you know, at the time of the surgery with the lysis subadhesions, and you know. Not to pass the buck, because it's not passing the buck, but, you know, that they were following her postoperatively. So, in other words, she was doing everything in her care. She was doing everything in her ability to make sure that the patient was receiving the safest and best care, not only during the surgery, but after the surgery as well, particularly when she was having a little bit of a bumpy post-operative course. So in other words, she wasn't just going, oh, I can manage this, you know, all by myself. I mean, obviously they were going to be present as well because they were present at the surgery, but still in all, you know, including the consult in this case, you know, shows that she was taking the patient, you know, the concern seriously. So, you know, there's two possibilities here. Either the patient had an ileus and then subsequently developed an obstruction later on, or she could have had a partial obstruction or even a recurrent intermittent obstruction. In partial obstructions, the patients tend to complain of colicky pain, and it's usually after they eat. in a recurrent intermittent, if you're suspecting that, then you could give, Vanessa, as you said, you could give the IV and oral contrast. But again, only if you're pretty confident that the patient doesn't have a full-blown obstruction, because we wouldn't want them to aspirate the contrast. Okay. I think your description of the ileus and the small bowel obstruction, both on physical exam as well as x-ray, was good. On x-ray, we would tend to see, in the case of an ileus, we would tend to see air in the rectum. That's kind of a hallmark feature there. Incidence of ischemia, if you have a complete obstruction, is anywhere, you'll love this, Vanessa, between 7 and 42%. So I think your numbers were spot on. More common in a complete obstruction versus a partial. And interestingly, patients can still pass gas and even actually have bowel movement for up to 12 to 24 hours after the onset of symptoms. So they could start having nausea and vomiting and distension and still be passing some gas for, you know, anywhere from half a day to a day, but still have an obstruction. So kind of clearing their system. And that kind of makes sense because stuff that's already passed through the constriction point, you know, obviously can still move through and can still be expelled. It's just that it stops after a period of time because obviously patient's obstructed. So I think that's it. Hopefully, sorry that Ashley wasn't on, but hopefully this would help if you had a case that was similar, help explain how to defend it. Does anybody have any questions about this or anything else that we talked about tonight? Any questions at all, guys? Well, if there are no more questions, then we will conclude the call. The next conference will occur on the 3rd of September. I believe Dr. Shamroff will be back for that one. And I really appreciate y'all dialing in tonight and for the participation and the questions. Thank you very much. Have a great week and good luck with your studying and board prep. Good night.